My name is Mark Casagrande, and I am here representing MARCH, which is an acronym for Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. MARCH is a trade organization representing the nearly 300 substance abuse treatment providers in Minnesota, as well as the over 48,000 clients they served last year alone. Thank you for this opportunity. According to the federal government, our great state is ranked 48th in the nation when it comes to the number of clients in treatment based on population. We're 48th. According to our own DHS, approximately 7% of the Minnesotans who needed substance abuse treatment actually received services. A reason for this is the current qualifying income. To qualify for the CD treatment fund, a Minnesotan must make less than 100% of the poverty rate, which is currently $10,400 a year. We ask you to consider Senate File 371 that would increase that qualifying income to be 165%. Unfortunately, the current system forces an individual to lose their job before they qualify for the CD treatment fund, despite the fact that studies show that employment increases their likelihood of remaining sober. Another reason for these statistics is the provider reimbursement rates. As you can see in the handout, over the last 10 years, our rate increases have overwhelmingly lagged behind that of the inflation rates. We beg you, do not support the governor's proposal to freeze our rates again. Another rate freeze will cripple our ability to serve the clients who need us the most. Because how it works is the insurance companies like Medica, UCare, MHP tie their rates in with this consolidated fund rate. So when you freeze that rate, you also freeze our ability to ask them for more money, which results in them raising more revenue at the expense of our clients. Unfortunately, these two changes that we're asking for are not cost neutral during a time of a nearly $1 billion deficit, which brings me to our solution. We are proposing a solution that would not only fund the financial impacts of these changes, but contribute approximately $200 million towards the deficit. By raising the alcohol user fee that has not been adjusted for over 20 years, Senate File 779 would finally force those individuals who use our services to pay for our services. A nickel a drink at the wholesale level would not only raise enough money to fully fund all of substance abuse treatment, but it would also contribute towards law enforcement, the courts, and community corrections. In addition, studies show that any increase in the cost of alcohol reduces underage drinking. As many of you already know, treatment works. Study after study proves it. Treatment reduces the use of alcohol and other drugs. It reduces criminal behavior. It reduces emergency room and psychiatric admissions while increasing our productivity. But cut after cut after cut has led us to be ranked 48th in the nation. We ask you to make these difficult yet necessary modifications in order to bring us to where we need to be. Thank you again.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Cornyn.
Madam Chair and Mr. Casagrande.
Yes.
Where do you come up with this? Whose study is this that you come up with that we're number 48th? I don't know that I buy that.
Okay. I would be happy to give you a copy. It actually came out of DHS, our Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services. They produced this report in January of this year that outlines the 48th in the nation actually comes from SAMHSA, which is under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And they do a survey of all clients that are in treatment, and they base that on population. That's where the 48th comes from. Okay. And I'd be happy to give you this copy
of DHS. I should probably look at that. I guess I think we do a pretty good job here in Minnesota, and to say that you were number 48th, I guess I find that a little hard to believe. But, and then, Madam Chair, if I can ask another question. Last time I checked, alcohol is legal in this country, and, back in the prohibition days it wasn't, and that didn't seem to work. But, I guess maybe I'm just grumpy this morning, but alcohol If we want to get rid of all substance or chemical abuse, why don't we try to just make alcohol illegal? You know, I mean, would your organization be in favor of that? I mean, I'd certainly be in favor of introducing that bill.
With all due respect, Senator, actually prohibition did reduce the use of alcohol and crime during that period. I'm not in a position to say yes or no whether or not March would support that legislation. Mm-hmm. I would be happy to bring that back to our board and ask for their guidance.
Yeah.
As far as the effects of alcohol abuse, studies consistently show 1 out of 3 families are impacted by addiction, 1 out of 3. Mm-hmm. My guess is somebody within your family or somebody that you know has been impacted by addiction.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Other questions? I think maybe if you could just explain a little bit when you say 48th.
Sure.
Do you mean 48th in terms of what we pay, 48th in terms of the number of people that get treatment, 48th in terms of the number of treatment facilities per capita? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to measure, and it's not really clear when you say 48th in the nation what you mean.
48th in the nation is based on the number of clients in substance abuse treatment or the number of clients receiving substance abuse treatment based on population. Did that clarify your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. The next person is Rachel Cheetah.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rachel Cheetah, and I work with Access Healthcare. And Access Healthcare is the disability care coordination organization that partners with UCare Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to offer the MINDO program, Minnesota Disability Health Options Program, which is an alternative for people with physical disabilities who are in the medical assistance program. The MINDO program has been around for 6 years. And it's recognized nationally as a kind of pilot program in regards to the integrated funding, the building of the medical home that we do, the kind of the coordinated care across the continuum, you know, where we do everything from the long-term care waiver services, et cetera, to acute care hospital stays, nursing home relocation, and we've got a large focus on preventive care. Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal includes a recommendation to remove home and community-based waiver services from the MINDO program for people who join the program after July of this year. So instead of a single health care home with integrated acute and waiver dollars, new enrollees would have a separate case manager at the county level to manage waiver services. Eliminating access to integrated funding would disrupt much of the positive preventive care and health maintenance activities we've been able to provide and further fragment care for individuals with disabilities. Our request is that you reject the governor's proposal and continue to allow for integrated care coordination and further evaluation of the MINDO model. And there is a fact sheet, that's the one with the Access logo, that has some information on the back in terms of some of the different clinical and quality care initiatives where we've been successful, I think, in terms of some of the cost savings for people with disabilities. And Deanne Rice, who's one of our care coordinators, has some other things to speak to.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for allowing me to testify. I'm here to encourage you to keep MINDO whole. The proposed changes to the MINDO program would negatively affect the members and the nursing care we provide them. I am a care coordinator, a public health nurse, who has worked for the last 5 years with Access. Prior to that, I worked as a CAC, CADI, and TBI case manager with Hennepin County. I have over 30 years of nursing experience. In addition to my decade of working with people with disabilities, my other experiences include emergency room intensive care, sexual assault nurse, clinician occupational, and international nursing care working with refugees. I feel fortunate to have found this position that allows me to assess and coordinate care for our members across the entire continuum of care through their hospital stays, their nursing facility stays, and back into the community. Having the authority to initiate and monitor home and community-based services, the waiver, is a key component of that continuum. I have some concerns. Number one, duplication and redundancy. Access care coordinators assess and work with members to assess the holistic needs and goals of the members we serve. If waivers were removed, our members who need waivered services would have completely separate assessment with another entity. Would this allow us to be nimble and fulfill the mission of our for our MINDO clients, which includes the right care at the right time, in the right place, and being cost-effective? Would I be spending precious care coordination time trying to get a hold of a county subcontractor rather than with the member to meet their needs and goals? I have an example. Sherry, she's 23. She has a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, unspecified psychosis, conversion disorder, seizure disorder, obesity, and asthma. Sherry had multiple hospitalizations because of problems with her AV shunt and her implanted baclofen pump malfunction. Her coping skills were affected by all these health concerns. She got angry easily. When angry, she turned it inward, and she became suicidal. Within a short amount of time, she had over five hospitalizations and multiple emergency room visits for her mental health. Behavior services were initiated by our Access team. These professionals worked with her assisted living staff, creating and implementing a behavior program to help Sherry. In the last 18 months, she has not had any hospitalization. She's now planning on attending school, has started a regular exercise program, and is losing weight. Would she have benefited from another agency such as the state to manage her long-term care benefits? One of the recommendations of the behavioral professional was to decrease the number of people who were involved with the member to increase the consistency of interaction and cares. A second concern is, how do we improve the quality and effectiveness of these waivered services? Removing waivered services from the MINDO program would take energy away from reaching one of the goals outlined in the CAN DO initiative, which is to improve the quality of care. Access intimately and holistically knows our members and their needs and goals. If we were not in the position of initiating, monitoring, and evaluating waivered services, it would greatly impact how we could affect change with providers and their services. Finding appropriate housing with services for our complex member is a challenge. Without access to the waiver benefits through MINDO, we would not be able to develop those type of relationships with providers and create new, desperately needed housing options so that we can keep our young people with disabilities living in the community. A third concern is that the change in waivered services would not be in alignment with the goals to simplify and integrate services for persons with disabilities. We currently serve a 7-county metro area and have found unique processes in each county on how intake to waivers is initiated and how decisions are made about their needs and services. MINDO was initiated by the state to provide integrated services, and with this proposed change, those gains would be lost. The 7 different systems and decision trees brings exponentially increased complexity to serving our members. In my experience, one of the weaknesses of the county system can be that often cumbersome and conflicting administrative and funding structure with inequities between the counties. I have a real-life example. Access assisted in relocating a young woman, Susie, from Courage Center. She had been assaulted by a boyfriend, which resulted in a traumatic brain injury. She had a history of methamphetamine abuse and was the mother of 2 young children under the age of 5. She moved from one county to another as she became more independent. Waivered services were initiated, which assisted her in learning independence, living skills, parenting skills, and modifying her home to allow her to function safely. She was able to gain back custody of her children and is now caring for them. She currently is no longer in need of waivered services, but what a great example of how integration of care works to make lives of families and individuals who have disabilities better. Because we could surround her with the care coordination and services she needed at the right time, in the right place, and in the right setting, she is now drug-free and once again independent and a full-time mother to her children. I appreciate the challenge we have as Minnesotans to deal with the budget deficit, but I strongly feel that removing waivered service from the MnDOE program does not serve people with disabilities, some of our most vulnerable citizens, well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Larson is next. I'd just like to remind people that we would like to hear your comments about the governor's budget. If you have a concern about a budget cut that was made in 2003, or you want to lobby about another bill that's in the legislature, if you could do that some other time, because we have a pretty long list of people who need to testify about the governor's budget. Thank you.
Madam Chair and fellow senators, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota, and I'm also co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And CCD is an organization of over 100 disability organizations whose primary mission is to advocate and support individuals with disabilities. And I do want to thank the legislature for its support of persons with disabilities in the legislation that was passed in 2007. The governor's supplemental budget proposal follows on the heels of some substantial cuts that the federal government is making in such programs as targeted case management. So Minnesota is suffering doubly with this recommendation, as well as those cuts of up to $60 million in targeted case management that Minnesota will receive this, or will not receive $60 million this year from the federal government. One of the positive things in the governor's supplemental budget is the sheltered needy portion, in which he funds the housing additional dollars that complements the legislation that was passed last year on the self-directed supports option. And this will mean that several thousand individuals that are currently receiving personal care attendance services will have the ability to move towards a model where they have greater control over their resources. This moves us in the direction of individuals having control over the resources, such as in our consumer-directed programs. And CCD wants to work not only on pushing the system towards consumer direction, but also greater use of technology and other cost savings means in the future. The governor's budget itself impacts persons with disabilities in a variety of ways. Starting with the restrictions in Minnesota Care, many persons on Minnesota Care are families that are headed by an individual with disabilities, or there are children with disabilities in many of those families. So they're impacted by the cuts in Medicare. We've heard dramatic testimony about the impact of the 2% cut in the COLA for the upcoming year. The Pioneer Press, in an editorial a week ago, called this a provider cut. It's not a provider cut. It's a cut to direct support professionals who are the backbone in providing services to individuals with disabilities and the elderly. The governor's budget calls for a payback by counties of over $4 million on the for counties that overspent on the developmental disabilities waiver. The way that program is managed, first of all, there was an excess of funds in that waiver program for those years, and secondly, the information that the counties had is not necessarily timely. It's been difficult for them to manage. They're getting better at that. The information is getting better, but we don't see that the benefit to individuals with disabilities in demanding that those counties pay that back. We feel that the caps on the CADI and TBI waivers will force individuals to stay in institutional placements, which are more expensive, and not be able to access community services. So we oppose those. And finally, we had testimony, and we'll have further testimony on the MnDOE program. We feel that this integrated model of services is a state-of-the-art program and should grow rather than be limited in its growth in the future. This legislature, this body, has shown courage in the past. We've heard stories of courage of the families that were here last week telling about how they get through each day in supporting an individual with disabilities and their families and the financial hardships that that has. We've heard story, or we know in the past, that this body has shown courage by shutting down government in 2005 in order to support low-income individuals and individuals with disabilities by maintaining their programs. And we know that courage was shown by this body in passing transportation bill this session. And so we would like to work with you in order to balance a budget, but not on the backs of persons with disabilities this year. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks very much. Dory Munch and Trish Townsend.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity you've provided for us to speak on the governor's proposed budget cuts as they relate to long-term care in our state. My name is Trish Townsend. I'm the CEO of Minnesota Valley Health Center that's located in Le Sueur, Minnesota. I want to briefly comment on the effects of the proposed budget cuts on global or statewide issues, local perspective, and then more from a personal perspective. As this committee knows, under the governor's budget plan, the rebasing statute that was to take effect October 1st, 2008 is completely repealed. This means no money at all for nursing facilities in 2008. The 2% rate increase is to be provided July 1st of 2008 for all other long-term care programs, such as elderly waiver and alternative care, is also completely eliminated. Any new funding has been postponed until 2009. I can speak most personally probably to our local level, and I need to do that from an historical perspective in where we are coming from and how difficult any kinds of cuts right now or any refusal to rebase will really be very devastating for many nursing homes and many long-term care or elderly programs throughout our state. My major emphasis is in our local area because that's what I can speak to you about. If you look at the yellow page in front of you, it says Minnesota Valley Healthcare Nursing Home Rate Disparity Summary. Going into this proposal by the governor, we already are at a great precarious situation in our own local nursing home. And I need to present that to you from a historical level. We are located in Le Sueur, population of about 4,000 to 5,000 people. We're a critical access hospital. We have an 80-bed long-term care facility, and we're celebrating our 50th year in 2009. Since 2001, our nursing home has accumulated losses of $3.6 million. This is an 80-bed nursing home in a small community. As a result of substantially lower MA reimbursement rates compared to all other facilities in our five-county surrounding area, we're already at a disadvantage with our neighbors. Comparing the Minnesota Department of Human Services nursing home database, we were paid $21.64 less per standard resident day than the average of our eight closest neighbors in as far as nursing homes. That's not just metro comparison or rural comparison. That's our eight closest neighbors within 18 miles. Our nursing home losses will jeopardize our ability to keep our hospital open in our community. These losses have come directly at the expense of the hospital and the nursing home assets and our ability to keep up to date with the technology, diagnostics, electronic medical records, even the physical plant that's necessary. In MVHC, if the MVHC nursing home is closed, which is certainly something we're having to face probably this year, especially if this budget is approved, the existing residents have to locate in a very difficult market. MVHC has a 99% occupancy rate, mostly MA patients or residents. Of the 79 current residents, 75 are from Le Sueur. These are our elders. This is our history. Of the 594-bed nursing homes in that 20-mile radius of Le Sueur, only 30 beds were available at the time that we did this survey for Senator Dahl and for Representative Broad. Of those beds, one nursing home is also looking at not filling 15 of those. So we're talking for 79 people, now 80, that there were 15 beds available within 20 miles. Where will they go, and where will the future nursing home residents go? In Le Sueur County, 13.7% of our population are over the age of 65, as it compared to the state average of 12.1%. There exists a real need to keep MVHC Nursing Home open. The MVHC Nursing Home has been recognized by MAHA with an Excellence in Practice Award this past year and has received the 2007 five-star status on the Minnesota State Report Card. We provide 129 jobs in Le Sueur County from just the long-term care side with a payroll of $3.2 million a year. Closure of the nursing home would result in resident relocation, likely causing long-distance commutes for families and also disconnect from their community. We can no longer financially subsidize the MA residents in the nursing home. Receiving the average MA payment made to the surrounding nursing homes would provide parity and sufficiency to continue the excellent history of care to Le Sueur County. Obviously, our issue is already a problem. We're already in trouble. Our elders are already being jeopardized. With this budget that the governor's proposing, it will be absolutely devastating to us. And the fact that no new funding will be considered until 2009. We're already working with our legislators, again, out of respect for Senator Berglund in this committee. I won't go into that bill that's before the two bodies. But from the perspective of this bill, we're already fighting an uphill, a severe uphill battle. From a personal level, in the words of my two-year-old grandson, I'm scared. I'm scared for our country, and I'm scared for our state. If we are truly to be judged by how we care for our elderly and our children, I do not think bailing out large banks and large businesses is the way that we're going to serve that purpose. Thank you for allowing our comments, and I certainly accept any questions.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barb Roop. Is she not here? Okay, then Carol Spector.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Carol Spector, and I am the Advocacy and Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund Minnesota is a statewide organization that engages in research, public education, and advocacy to improve the lives of children and their families. And I'm here today to express some concerns regarding the impact of the governor's budget proposal on Minnesota children. The governor's budget proposal would cut funding for increased access to health care for more than 20,000 children. Eliminating the funding for the transitional MA program would leave 20,000 children uninsured, and eliminating the outreach dollars would leave thousands more uninsured. Both of these policies were enacted last session because they address some barriers, access barriers in our system. I want to highlight with the outreach funding that 75% of uninsured children are believed eligible for public programs, and the outreach money would help find those children and get them enrolled. Just very briefly, investing in children's health is very important for both for all children, our communities, and the healthcare system. Uninsured children are more likely to have unmet medical needs, and they're four times more likely to use the emergency room. In addition, insured children miss less school and perform better in school than their uninsured counterparts. I think that over the couple days of testimony, the point has been highlighted that in times of economically difficult times, that cutting services to low-income people is the wrong direction to go. And I highlight that point as well. And just to put an exclamation point on that, we really have been moving backwards in terms of the well-being of children in this state over the past several years. We now have 152,000 children living in poverty. That number of children has increased by 35% since 2000. And even more troubling, the number of children living in extreme poverty has doubled. And extreme poverty is 50% of the poverty level, which is the poverty level is just above $20,000 for a family of four. In addition, we have been seeing an increase in the number of uninsured children during that same period, and we're up to 85,000 uninsured children right now. So last year, we really began to reverse that trend for children with these changes. The legislature paved the way to health care coverage for 37,000 uninsured children, and the governor's budget proposal would undo most of those gains. We really applaud the health care reform debate that has been occurring since the end of last session, and that will move us closer to universal coverage, and we think the governor's budget proposal is a step in the wrong direction. And finally, the governor's proposal cuts access expansions, expansions to health care, which are appropriate uses for the health care access fund. And at the same time, he's taking money from the health care access fund. Children's Defense Fund strongly advocates using the health care access fund for what it was intended for, and that's to provide access to health care coverage for Minnesotans. We understand the enormity of the task before the legislature this session, but urge the legislature to continue the leadership it showed last session in investing in the health of Minnesota children and the future of our state. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Lynn, Megan.
Good morning, Senator Berglund and members of the committee. I am Lynn Megan, here representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition and MnDACA Association, representing day training habilitation services for people with disabilities throughout Minnesota. Jointly, we provide services to over 14,000 people with severe disabilities, a range of disabilities severe to pretty capable folks serving 87 counties around our state. DTNH services provide employment, community involvement, therapies, transportation, and other individualized services to some of Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens. I am employed as president of TSE, Incorporated Provider serving Ramsey County. The governor's proposed cuts of a 2% inflation adjustment, or COLA, create significant challenges for all of our providers. The quality of our services is completely reliant on competent and reliable staff and experience of our staff team. Without adequate compensation, providers are unable to recruit and retain quality staff. Direct service members, on average in Minnesota, are paid less than $10 an hour. For that wage, people can get jobs with a lot less stress and personal responsibility. Last year, when the 2% COLA increases were passed for each year of the biennium, we shared that information with our staff. They helped talk with you to be able to get that, talk about the 2% that, or any COLA that they need. Now, we may have to give them the message that there will be no increases in 2008. The frustration that staff feel over low, stagnant wages affects their job satisfaction. Most of our staff work several jobs to survive in today's economy. Another way to state that our staff members cannot help but feel they are not valued by our state leaders. Please understand a choice they are making to take away that you and the governor, that we are seeing that the governor is wanting to take away funds that were already set aside for wage increases. So we ask you to not consider that. Providers do not have resources to give wage increases without the COLA adjustments. Fixed costs and transportation expenses have risen at a rate that outpaces any COLA and other inflation throughout Minnesota. This past year, we surveyed our association members to gather further information in the transportation area. We are required by state licensing regulations to provide transportation for all the people that we serve. In 2007, the people responding just over 50% of the total of our providers, which was a great response, totaled a net loss of over $9 million in the transportation area alone. At TSC, we provide transportation to over 250 people daily. The expenses for our transportation has increased approximately 25% in each of the past 3 years. Without increases to cover these additional expenditures, we have had to limit other supports by leaving vacant positions unfilled and other reductions. Couple the transportation expense with the increase in the cost of employee benefits, such as health care, and the reality that there is no way to continue to provide the same level of quality of services to the people that we serve. If the COLA that you passed within the 2008-10 budget last year is not implemented, we are at risk of losing valuable federal match dollars. Please take action to retain the 2% provider rate increase. People we serve depend on your leadership in assuring that service providers they depend on can continue to meet their needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Again, thank you. Laura Campbell.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Laura Campbell, and I manage an adult day program for Volunteers of America of Minnesota in South Minneapolis. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Adult Day Services Association. MASDA supports adult day programs that help people stay in their communities without social isolation while providing necessary support to their caregivers. MASDA must voice its opposition to delaying the 2% long-term care COLA a full year. We have struggled to deliver economical community services. The 2% COLA expected this July was barely enough to keep services on an even keel. Having no rate increase until the middle of 2009 will have these kind of effects on adult day services. Difficulty in hiring, sustaining quality staff, and ultimately the quality of care that we can provide. Licensing and COA, Council on Accreditation, requires workers with experience and or college degrees. Workers on average make $10 to $15 per hour. Many are part-time and don't receive benefits. Unlike teachers and other public employees, they will not receive a pension and don't have extended vacation time. Our staff is dedicated and they work very hard. They meet the needs of participants with a variety of mental health and physical disabilities. They want to stay in their jobs, but it's hard to move forward when they don't receive a COLA. They need to be valued and compensated for the work they do. Every time we lose a staff person, it costs a minimum of $500 to replace the person in terms of training and advertising. Training and staff ratios that have been determined by the legislature. How do we fund the COLA? Well, I ask, how can we not fund the COLA? Statistics show, and I'm sure you've all heard this, that the baby boomers will be turning 65 in 2011. And the Alzheimer's Association is showing 10 million of our elders will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. If people have to go to residential facilities because adult day services are not available, the cost will be higher in the long term. The following figures have been taken from the 2007 MetLife Mature Market Institute study. The average annual cost for a semi-private nursing home is $76,650. The average cost for a one-bedroom assisted living apartment is $31,572, and that's just boarding, room and board. You have to add another $1,000 per this study to do per month for extra services. But in my area, calling some of the assisted livings, they're showing a rate of $1,800 per month, which brings up to around $44,000 per year. If a person attends our adult day program 5 days a week, it costs $15,624 per year. Now, many of the participants, they don't need full-time adult day. They need part-time placement, and they can still stay in their homes with their families. The cost of an adult day service is often less than a visit from a home health aide nurse and about half the cost of a skilled nursing facility care. It's too simple to say that freezing adult day services rates make a savings. If working caregivers cannot count on day service for their loved ones, they may have to give up their jobs and care for their loved ones at home. This means increased unemployment and people with going without health insurance. The legislature has made a commitment to cost-effective services for our seniors, which means keeping them out of nursing homes. To do this, we need strong community programs with qualified and consistent workers, which the governor's proposal puts in jeopardy. Thank you for letting me come today.
Any questions? Thank you very much. John Chita?
Madam Chair, members of the division, I'm going to be speaking on John Cheetah's behalf today.
Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christian Knights, and I work with the Courage Centre. We serve a vast population of people with disabilities, both with outpatient and inpatient work. I won't take too much of your time. I'd first like to echo Steve Larson's sentiments that the governor's budget, coupled with some of the federal level decisions, will really hit the disability community hard. With kind of a worrying double hit. I'll touch on two key issues today. The first is related to the MINDO program. The governor's budget removes the waiver services from the MINDO program. Right now, people with disabilities make one phone call with one point of contact to have all their services, both health and social services, coordinated. With the governor's proposal, it would mean that people with disabilities would have at least two coordinators or case managers to make those decisions. One would be for medical services with MINDO, and the other would be from the county for the waived services. Everything that's been talked about this session and everything in the Healthcare Access Commission that's good, whether it be medical home, care coordination, paying for preventative services, is in place today in the MINDO program already. So we really feel strongly about keeping the MINDO program and the way it is. The second point I want to touch on is the waiver cap issues. A lot of what we work with on Courage is really to make people get their lives back and become independent once again. By taking away caps such as the TBI, CADI, or CAC, it's forcing people a lot of the time to stay in institutions, which also costs more money for the state. But more importantly, it damages a vital part that many Minnesotans with disability have, which is their independence. And we feel very strongly that, you know, this is not only just from a money-saving perspective, but also a human perspective. I have letters here from my CEO, Jan Malcolm, to hand out, and I thank the committee for their commitment to healthcare reform, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Greg Klukris.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Klugertz. I'm here to represent Regents Hospital and Health Partners. As you might expect, I'm here to express concerns about the governor's proposal to close the $935 million budget deficit. And while we understand the urgency and the gravity of the situation and the calculus that leads to this division of the budget as heavily relied upon to close the gap, we think it's really only possible when you think of it as a calculus and ignore the human impact of the proposal. We think we firmly believe that this relies too heavily on the division and that it places people at risk and the organizations that dutifully serve the people who require good work. And we can't continue to rely on Health and Human Services to solve the state's budget problems. In response to a tragedy last summer, the work that you needed to do was evident, and you needed to do it quickly. And you did it. It seems that in response to the tragic combination of low income, uninsurance, and disability, we don't quite know what to do. and that every time there's a state deficit, we aim back at eligibility or funding as the solution. Regents Hospital is a safety net provider and will be greatly impacted by these cuts. In 2007 alone, Regents provided almost $42 million of uncompensated care with over 20,000 patients. The underlying cost of that is somewhere in the teens to $20 million. The proposed shifts, reductions, and delays, eliminations of eligibility will have a disproportionate impact on safety net hospitals, because we know that in the state of Minnesota, care for the uninsured and service to Medicaid clients is concentrated in a handful of hospitals, at least, and among the doctors that work most closely with those hospitals. Also troubling, as mentioned before, but I would like to provide our emphasis, it's troubling that the Health Care Access Fund is also being regarded as a solution. It is there through either the agency of health care providers who collect it or through the payment directly from taxpayers over a bargain that said that the money would be used for access. This is a bargain that's understood when it comes to license tabs and roads and hunting licenses and the outdoors, but seems to be not understood when a tax is collected from healthcare consumers. And given the problems related to access that we face every day in our hospitals, we think that, and throughout actually the healthcare community, not just hospitals, we think taking the Health Care Access Fund and placing it in the general fund, where the money will sort of wash over all of the funding done through the general fund and be sort of almost indistinguishable, it will fund everything else in the state except for the one purpose that the tax was collected for, and I don't think that's right. Finally, we think these proposals are in direct conflict with the state-sponsored recommendations for reform. We're at a time when the healthcare community is asked to be more accountable for access, quality, and cost. We see proposals that will actually reduce access and shift costs. Specifically at Regents Hospital, there are two items that I'd like to speak to. Rebasing delays. When the contractor was asked to bid to replace the bridge, it would have been silly for people to think that the contractor should bid based on 2004 costs and collect those in 2009. And yet this proposal asks exactly for that. It asks for us to receive costs in 2009 based on 2004 costs and goes against the bargain that would have that we had accepted, where we would have accepted, we would have taken the 2004 costs and collected them. Now we're asked to delay 1 year, an impact of 3 to 4%. Similarly, the contractor, after signing the contract, you wouldn't ask them to take a 3 to 4% cut. And it works exactly the same way with us. The bargain should be the same with us. We rely on these payments. The Medicaid compensation rates already are below cost by definition, given that method of determination, and a delay further drives those payments into the hole. And secondly, the inpatient hospital supplemental payments, the elimination of those at $2.8 million is a second slap. 2.6 related to rebasing delays and 2.8 supplemental payments. This is approximately the same amount as Regions just invested to prepare 16 behavioral health inpatient behavioral health beds in response to the chronic shortage of those types of facilities. And the impact in the future, we don't know which project specifically might be delayed or canceled as a result, but inevitably has that kind of impact. Then at the health plan, the increase in delay of the withhold has impact that potentially could be $5.7 million. If only the delay, the impact is $700,000. But we don't know what criteria might be established for the collection of the withhold, and if those are influenced by the deficit that we're experiencing, we might actually see the withhold not collected, and then the full impact of $5.7 million. When I come here and I hear the level of service and passion, commitment that is expressed by those who come ahead of me, it reinforces how difficult your task. I really commend the knowledge that you exhibit, the wisdom and dedication that you exhibit here, And I know that you'll collect these inputs and aim for the best solution, and I wish you well as you do that. I'm open to any questions you might have.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much for being here today. Dr. Al Michael.
Madam Chair, Berglund, and members, I appreciate being able to provide testimony regarding the governor's budget recommendation. And I thank you for all that you folks do in concern for health care in this state. My name is Al Michael, and I'm a physician and former chair of pediatrics and dean of the University of Minnesota Medical School. I'm currently a member of the steering committee for the healthcare access team of the Office of Social Justice of Catholic Charities, and also a member of the board of directors of St. Mary's Health Clinics, which is a nonprofit ministry of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet. We vigorously oppose the intent of the governor to transfer $250 million outright and the subsequent $149 million from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund. The 2% provider tax, which funds the Health Care Access Fund, should be used for its intended purpose to increase access to Minnesota care, which serves the poor. The use of the Health Care Access Fund to close the budget gap will adversely affect health care of the needy, repealing coverage, as Carol indicated, for 20,000 children in transition, limiting outreach grants, and repealing a small expansion of Minnesota care for adults without children. But I want to say a word about the St. Mary's Health Clinics, because the governor's recommendation will have a serious effect on St. Mary's Health Clinics, which provides access to thousands of low-income, poor families who are without health care coverage and who are not currently eligible for government subsidy programs. These are free clinics. Care is provided by volunteer physicians, nurses, other personnel. In addition, over 750 specialty physicians in the community are available to see patients in their own offices, usually without any charge. Seven hospitals offer outpatient and inpatient services at discounted rates. The majority of the patients have low-paying jobs, which do not offer health insurance, or they cannot afford the premiums, or they are in transition in their jobs. Most are on the brink of poverty. So this is a very unique clinic, probably the singular clinic in the state of Minnesota, which its total purpose is to deal with the poor. There are no other patients that come to this clinic. The operating budget of the clinics is derived almost solely from individual donations and fundraising and contributed services by volunteers. Transferring resources from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund will naturally limit available resources for Minnesota care. By not allowing new individuals to become covered under Minnesota care, St. Mary's clinics will no longer have the ability to move patients into permanent sources of funds for health care. This will directly impede the ability to accept new patients by St. Mary's health clinics. The only option, therefore, for these patients is to seek expensive, non-reimbursed emergency care. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Again, thank you for your testimony. We have a group of people from the Association for Non-Smokers. If they want to come up to the table together.
In the interest of time, as people are getting settled, my name is Jeannie Weigum. I'm a volunteer and president of the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota. The others who are speaking actually are not with the association but are interested in this topic. The topic we're here to talk about is the proposal in the governor's budget to cut $325,000 out of the $3.2 million the state currently spends on tobacco prevention. We brought a little bit of show and tell, and I wonder if the page could help us here. We're among only a couple of groups that are being impacted by the governor's cuts, where we're actually opposing a well-financed industry. We're actually working against a heck of a lot of money. And I'd like to just provide to you some of the things that the tobacco industry is actually distributing to our youth. You can pass these around. This whole hearing began a few days ago in what may seem to you like 1,000 years ago with the following statement from Governor Carlson. Do we continue to pay for faulty outcomes, or do we put more money into prevention? Every time there is a budget crunch, it is the prevention side that gets cut in order to pay for faulty outcomes. That is where this hearing began, and that's where we come back to this time. In 1986, this legislature increased the tobacco tax, and we were the first in the nation to take 0.5 cent of that tobacco tax and spend that half penny of tobacco tax on prevention programs for children. Back in 1986, that came to $1.6 million. Guess what happened? First time there was a budget crunch. The governor's budget called for a 30% cut in that money that came out of the tobacco tax, which was dedicated to prevention programs. In subsequent years, that $1.6 million was whittled down to, by 1993, it was down to $54,000. Those whittles started out with 30%, then 13% cut, then 7% cut. And finally, in order to get enough money out of it to amount to anything, there was a 77% cut. That's what we did to prevention back in 1986. Then some of you will remember the tobacco settlement. Over a period of 25 years, the tobacco industry has and will pour into this state $6.2 billion. And this legislature, in its infinite wisdom, dedicated nearly $1 billion to prevention funding, prevention of smoking and some other youth risk behaviors. That was in the year 2001. By 2003, we had again hit a budget snag. And some of you may remember, what we whacked back then was the entire endowment. We took all that money out of tobacco prevention. And what we were left with was $3.2 million annually for preventing youth from starting to smoke. It's an all-too-familiar picture. Prevention, as you well know on this committee, does not cost. It pays. It pays huge dividends. If we were to prevent 3 heart attacks over the course of a year with this funding, we would have covered the cost of this funding. We know that of children alive today, our Minnesota children, 118,000 of those children will die prematurely as a result of tobacco-related disease. We can impact that. We should be doing much more than $3.2 million. The federal government, CDC, actually recommends that we be spending about $12 per person. Today, the state of Minnesota is spending 60 cents per capita. with the budget cuts the governor recommends, will be down to about 50 cents per capita to prevent the leading preventable cause of death and disease in this country. I need to remind you, our $3.2 million in prevention funds is all we have to stand up to the kind of promotion you're seeing passing around the table. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Marshall. I'm a health educator with St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health, and I'm here to share some of the programs that we work through in the Ramsey Tobacco Coalition. So it brings it down to a local level and what's going on here and what we might very well lose. Now, our work has always been to prevent kids from ever starting that lifelong addiction to tobacco. And we work within Ramsey County, South St. Paul, and West St. Paul. Our project is funded through the Minnesota Department of Health, and we are the only source of tobacco prevention here in Ramsey County. We are it. And those pervasive things that are throughout our community sponsored by the tobacco companies are insidious. They invite young people to come and smoke, and there are a variety of ways. And as you note, some of the things that are passing around are very inviting. I mean, these are quality kinds of things, wonderful lighters and cigarette holders and cases. You draw people in with this. It is, as I said, it's insidious. We represent all the community agencies throughout Ramsey County. We also work very closely with the public school districts and some of the private schools. Our members, we have a complete list here if anyone is interested. And we also have the Tobacco Law Center as well as our health department. And we are partners throughout this. Our work is focusing on that point of sale advertising and the promotional sales that are targeted to youth. And we know youth are targeted. If you can hook someone on cigarettes in their teens, those brain receptors are there, and they are locked on for life. And if anyone has been a cigarette smoker, you know exactly what we talk about when we talk about addiction, because it doesn't end when you're 21. You say, I'm going to stop now. It doesn't work that way. It's a true addiction. And the industry has also continued working on the 18 to 25-year-old segment of our population as well. And I think I'll pass around this one night in Vegas. There are all sorts of ways that this can be done. This is a special night that is sponsored by Camel, and it really pulls in young people, and it brings in young women, and they do their makeup and their hair, and then they have a special limousine. They take them around to nightclubs, and this is tobacco money. Now, we in public health and in the private sector can't match that. And this is why it's so important for us to do prevention where we can. And this is what we have been doing with the Ramsey Tobacco Coalition since 1999. It began there, and of course, ANSWER has done quite a bit over the years, but we've concentrated on youth. And we are doing a number of things now within the schools and the youth groups. We have an entire curriculum working on that point-of-sale advertising. We have done surveys throughout the community. We know exactly how many places sell tobacco. We are also looking at donations that have come in to different organizations. And it's sort of a backdoor kind of thing sponsored by the tobacco industry. They have their own curriculum to prevent smoking. However, it's been found it hasn't been very effective. You know, we are then hoping our young people can look at their communities and go to some of these people who are selling cigarettes and saying, why are you doing this? Why are you tempting us? Why are you causing this kind of addiction or being a part of that type of addiction? Now, I know that you are all faced with a budget crisis, and there are different ways, I suppose, to do that, but an investment in your children is very important, and this is where we stand with our group here. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today.
The night in Vegas was actually not in Vegas. It was in Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis, yes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Sandell. I retired a few years ago after working in tobacco control for 20-odd years. Over that period of time, the state's commitment, as Ms. Wigum showed, to combat tobacco use has constantly waxed and waned. We get money from the tobacco tax, it disappears. We get money from the tobacco settlement, it disappears. And this means that the funding has always been very inefficient and very wasteful, because you start to build a structure with which to do tobacco control. It's defunded. The structure collapses. As Lisa Marshall pointed out, tobacco control work is based on community efforts. These require coalitions of schools, hospitals, doctors, other health care providers, law enforcement, social service agencies. These are not groups that you can get together like that. It takes years to build this kind of structure, and every time there are cuts, that structure collapses, only to be rebuilt perhaps a few years later. So I urge you to reject the $325 cut that of the tobacco programs that are sponsored by the Minnesota Department of Health. This is a pittance. It ought to remain in the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society. I very much appreciate having the opportunity to testify today. I'm here to ask you to oppose the governor's budget cuts that, if made, would set back the fight against cancer, Minnesota's leading cause of death. American Cancer Society is Minnesota's largest organization that works to eliminate cancer and works on a nonpartisan basis to advance sound, effective cancer policy. The Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access recognized the importance of chronic disease prevention. Several cancer prevention programs may be severely undermined if the governor's cuts became reality. The proposed 10% cut to the Youth Tobacco Prevention's grants program continues a policy of taking funding away from an area that Minnesota decided years ago, as Ms. Wigum mentioned, that it would dedicate funding for and protect, because tobacco prevention programs work. We ask this committee to say no more to the gutting of tobacco prevention programs. Our state is nowhere near the levels of funding for tobacco prevention that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends. Now, we've also heard in this debate over the budget that some have said that the enactment of the Freedom to Breathe law is a justification for cutting the Youth Tobacco Prevention Grants Program. This argument suggests a false choice and should be rejected. 76% of Minnesotans support the Freedom to Breathe, but this law does not focus on youth who are most susceptible to tobacco industry advertising. It's very important to protect the Youth Tobacco Grants Program, and it's just one of several key cancer-fighting programs. We also ask you today to oppose cuts to the governor's operating budget for the Department of Health, because such cuts would harm the SAGE breast and cervical cancer program and the cancer surveillance system. Since 1991, the SAGE program has saved lives, serving women who are un- or underinsured. This public-private partnership has served over 100,000 women, detected over 1,200 breast and cervical cancers, arranged for over 35,000 diagnostic procedures for women who with abnormal screening results and saved thousands of dollars in cost to the state and to consumers in the treatment of late-stage cancer. If cut, there would be potentially less funding from the CDC matching dollars that this program leverages, less staffing, less ability to reach out to women who need breast and cervical cancer. The cancer surveillance program, if cut, is Minnesota's data collection system. This is how we plan cancer policy in state, by using this system to collect critical data to affect policy and practice. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I know that you know that these programs are effective and vital. Recognizing the budget pressures you're under, I ask you to reject the budget cuts to the programs that not only work, including the Youth Tobacco Prevention Program that we've heard about that kids really need at this time, and also the SAGE program that serves a vital and vulnerable population until we have health care access for all. Minnesotans need life-saving and cost-saving programs, and that's what I ask you to defend here today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you all. Are there any questions? Thanks again. Ron Brandt.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ron Brand, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I want to comment on the governor's budget proposal. But first, before I do that, just a little bit about our member organizations. We provide, the community mental health centers provide an array of services, a variety of different services. About half of them are actually provide chemical dependency services. They provide psychiatry as well as long-term care or long-term type services of rehabilitation and case management and other safety net services that help people live independently in the community. Last year, we had a very significant and important budget year, I guess, for mental health, and we're glad for that. It still leaves many, many gaps in our program and many unfinished goals. And as I talk with you, you'll see that we still have a situation where many of the essential providers and clients are at risk due to increasing demand and scarce available resources. First, I'll comment about health reform. We've spent the last many months working on health reform, and we're saddened to hear the transfer of, I don't know if it's $250 million or $390 million out of that account. But, you know, it sounds abstract to think of numbers like that. But every day in every town, every neighborhood in communities served by our members, there are people who are seeking help, and they're only willing to seek help oftentimes for an emotional problem, a mental illness, or chemical dependency when a crisis occurs, when it becomes urgent or an emergency. And many people are uninsured at that point. And programs like that are essential for us to be able to provide the care at the right time in the right place for people. For our providers, high numbers of clients are uninsured. And it's natural if you think about it. People lose their job when they have these kinds of problems, or their families become difficult to hold together. They're also uninsured, where very high co-payments and deductibles or limited benefits would put care out of reach for them if it were not for our members' sliding fee schedules that enable them to be able to seek help. But like other safety net providers, this creates a situation where there's an accumulation of uncompensated care, and that threatens the provider's viability and ability to sustain their operations. In our most recent survey, our members' average profit margin — they're nonprofits, they're all nonprofits — but the average margin was 0.1%. That's their net margin, meaning essentially nothing. That's on average, meaning that most of them were losing money. So you can see in a situation like that why no COLA to the organizations would have a big impact. Their operating expenses are increasing. There's an increasing number of people who are uninsured and underinsured, and the health benefits, travel, and staff compensation. You've heard many, many, you know, arguments and stories about the COLA, but that affects our providers as well. In the mental health area, just to point out, many times much of the COLA that's dedicated to the mental health area is distributed in the form of grants, and the grants are not they're a block grant that goes to the community, to the counties. When there's a caseload growth and increasing staff costs, the staff costs might be covered in part by the COLA in the grant, but the increasing caseload costs are not covered. And that's a, you know, that's unique because it's not a rate increase, it's a grant increase. Just mental health, remind you that mental health is a huge factor in long-term care placements or extended stays in nursing homes and other places. It complicates welfare to work process for many, many people. A third of the workers' comp claims are due to stress and mental health disorders. It's, mental health is the fastest growing area probably of caddy waiver services. It's the second leading cause of hospital uncompensated care. Mental health often becomes a situation where it becomes number one, or not number one in people's priority list, but rather numbers two or three in the priority list. And thus it makes it sort of a likely target for cuts when people start ranking things. The good news is that we're in the midst of profound changes in how citizens view mental health and how we finance treatment. We begin to think of mental health services as a health benefit, and people expect to be covered in the same way as they are with other insurances. We're long past the days where people got help in asylums and went away for many years. We know treatment works and we know it is effective, but it's often a combination of medications and therapy and some of the longer-term supports that are financed in different ways. So in the budget, when there are different proposals in different areas, they accumulate in the providers that provide this kind of combination of services like our members. We are affected profoundly by the federal changes to targeted case management and the rehabilitative services that you've heard about. I talked with a member this morning, one of our member organizations this morning, who told me that they have shifted almost about $200,000 worth of services from things that used to be covered by medical assistance, rehab services for adults, and shifted it over to be covered by United Way and county grants or county property taxes just because of changing definitions of what's medically necessary. Other providers are saying, we don't know if we can provide the ARM services and some of the services any longer. Counties have cut contracts to targeted case management providers, half of which are provided by nonprofits. So we've made many great improvements in contracting. We've increased the number of psychiatrists that we have and advanced practice nurses and do more assertive outreach and treatment. But the diversified revenue that our members have is very difficult to sustain. The 4% cut to agency staff is a concern for us because in the last session there were significant new proposals that were funded, and we are concerned about whether or not or how we will be able to provide the staff assistance to those developing programs. So just to conclude, I don't think that we can expect to solve the state's budget crisis and budget problems on the backs of the Health and Human Services budget. In fact, there's something just profoundly odd and wrong in the way we forecast our spending and our revenues when we know that we will need more revenue and more of the government services that we're talking about here during times, bad economic times. And it's just, while that's an abstract concept, we see every day the impact it has on individuals and kids and families. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. Sue Abderholden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I have to admit, when I saw the budget proposal, I said, you know, not again. It seems like every time we need to cut money, you know, we have a budget shortfall, we always look at Health and Human Services. I think this year I kind of felt like when, you know, you've gotten hit by a bus and you kind of look up and you say, oh, thank God I'm alive, and you start walking away and you don't really realize some of the internal injuries that you've suffered. Because these cuts aren't clearly obvious. It's not like cutting general assistance medical care or cutting, you know, hundreds of thousands of people off Minnesota care. They're more subtle, but they really do injure our health and human service system. As Ron mentioned, last year we really had an unprecedented investment in mental health, particularly on the community side, which is really where people spend most of their lives, not in a hospital bed, but in the community. And so it really was important that we build up the community-based services. But unfortunately, in this proposed budget, what we're looking at is the community-based services getting hit. And those are the ones that really support people in the community. Over and over again, when we talk to adults with mental illness or we talk to families of kids who have a mental illness, what they say to us is one of the biggest issues is the lack of continuity of care, because the person that's working with them continues to leave and go somewhere else. And when we pay really, really low wages, when we don't provide, you know, yearly cost of living increases, I mean, gas alone went up for everyone. We need to make sure that these people who don't make much money at least get a small cost of living increase to compensate them for that. They're going to leave. They're going to go somewhere else. And then that disrupts the care and creates, frankly, kind of holes in our service system when we do that. So it's not necessarily, you know, a front page headline, but I think it really does unravel the stability of our community-based system. As was mentioned, the limit on the CADI waivers is problematic for people with mental illness. That has been the way that we've been able to move people who've been inappropriately placed in a nursing home or to move them out into what we consider good adult foster care arrangements. That has really worked well for people. And now we're just kind of getting used to using it. You know, we're kind of cutting it off again. So we think that's really untimely. I also want to talk about the access to insurance. I spent you know, better part of the fall, working with Senator Sharon on how we're going to kind of combine social services and health care. And when you combine the federal cuts with some of the state cuts, you wonder if there's anything left to combine. And, you know, I just think that that's a real problem for those who are perhaps the most vulnerable in our society and need the most intensive coordination. And as Ron mentioned, too, people do need insurance. When you don't have insurance, you do wait until there's a crisis, and that is far more costly. And not allowing those kids who would have been on the transitional MA is also problematic. We see a lot of kids who have mental health issues whose parents can't get them services and supports that they need to be successful in school and at home. I do want to mention the staff reductions as well. Normally, I'm not, you know, here to defend the Department of Human Services, although we've obviously been working well with them the last couple of years. But we do have a lot of new initiatives that needed to be carried out. These are people that I call on the weekends, and they're working there trying to figure out how to get the money out for crisis services or the school link services. They do work really, really hard, and we do worry that, you know, we're not going to be able to add the staff that we need to really carry out those initiatives you passed last year. And finally, you know, we didn't do everything last year. Last year was a first step in transforming the mental health system, not the last step. And we had really hopes for doing much, much more. We knew a lot of those hopes would be dashed when we saw that the budget wasn't increasing. But, you know, the discussion at the Capitol has been, frankly, about hospital beds and not the need for crisis homes, you know, for more ACT teams, you know, to really beef up our armed services, our CTSS services. You know, we've talked about the Ready to Launch program from Senator Lori, so to make sure, you know, kids, many of whom have a mental illness, aging out of the foster care system, have access to health care, have access to those community supports like any 18 to 20-year-old, 21-year-old should have. We never even covered employment programs last year, and really the road to recovery is a job, not sitting in your apartment all day, smoking cigarettes and watching daytime TV. So we have so much left to do that I just worry about what's going to happen. I know that you have a really tough job ahead of you, but I just want you to remember that the community-based side of our mental health system is truly the most important and will keep people living well in the community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. Is there a representative of Hennepin County Medical Center? Welcome to the committee, if you would identify yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lynn Abrahamson, the Chief Executive Officer of Hennepin County Medical Center. And we'd like to express our thoughts today relative to the governor's supplemental budget proposal. We can appreciate the economic predicament all Minnesotans face right now, and we appreciate that the proposed budget does not generally reduce the number of people who have been eligible for Minnesota's public programs or current payment levels to providers. However, we do feel an obligation to speak on behalf of those people we serve and the role we play in addressing the state's health care needs and the possible implications of the proposed funding reductions. Many of the committee members know us. We're known for our standby capacity as the state's first and largest Trauma One center. Our program scope that includes all general acute services, including mental health, an outpatient clinic system which serves more than 350,000 visits in five different locations, and our role in education, which includes 280 physicians in training, 125 of whom in primary care training. While we are only one of 135 hospitals in the state, we provide 16 to 18% of all the hospital services needed by the uninsured and Minnesota Public Program enrollees. I can tell you, as the CEO of this hospital, we're working extremely hard to provide value for each dollar the state pays for health care. We're in the process of transforming our very care model to assure that we are providing the right care in the right setting, with a health professional team that is motivated to provide public sector sensitivity and private sector productivity. We have changed our very governance structure, our human resource system, installed an electronic health record. Our full-time equivalent staff per unit of service is the lowest that it has been in years. And still, while we are aggressively working on all of those fronts, I don't mind telling you that our safety net hospital is still experiencing economic duress. Last year, the county contributions to HCMC from tax support and our operating loss totaled $36 million. The two biggest hits to HCMC within this budget proposal are rebasing and the deferred disproportionate share payments. Rebasing is now scheduled to occur in 2008 to move from rates based on 2002 costs less 11.5% to cost based on 2004, with the rate changes to take effect January of 2009. If this does not happen, for HCMC, that would mean we lose the scheduled rate increase and therefore a $6 million reduction in fiscal year 2009 and an additional $6 million reduction in fiscal year 2010. Further, if Minnesota HCMC is not able to secure the available disproportionate share payments, which requires CMS approval of the state plan amendment, HCMC itself would forego reimbursement of $1.5 million in fiscal year 07, $3 million in fiscal year 08, and $3 million plus, including a scheduled 16% increase in fiscal year for 2009. Therefore, these timing changes alone would result in a $9 million loss in annual revenue in 2009. And, of course, I don't mind telling you that's real money. And, of course, the state could actually compensate 60 to 80 primary care physicians to keep our state healthy with that particular amount of money. The last point I would like to make is related to the Health Care Access Fund. The provider tax came into being and has been levied on health care providers with the express purpose of creating a means to assure access to care. The fund could be very useful in either expanding access, in extending coverage, or as possibly bridge funding while health care reform is taking place in Minnesota. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abramson, can you expand a little bit more on what the delay of those DSH payments? It looks to me like it's a delay of 1 month of the payment, but that's a significant cost differential for you.
Okay. Ms. Abrahamson.
Yes, thank you for the question. I will actually ask Mr. Haristall if he's got that answer.
Hello. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Haristall, the Vice President for Public Policy at Hennepin County Medical Center. And this isn't about the one-month delay that is also envisioned in another portion of the budget. I think this is specific to the supplemental payments for that's alluded to in another line of the budget.
Okay. Oh.
Hospital supplemental payments. Any further questions?
We don't like Mr. that Hairstall. Delay either, but that's a comparatively small amount relative to the other two items.
Any further questions or comments? Senator Prettner-Solon.
I What does this do? Does it eliminate the payment altogether, or does it just delay the payment?
Mr. Haristall.
Madam Chair, Senator, it reduces the amount of the payment. We do get some dollars currently, but this negates the projected increases that have been scheduled to occur.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Neil Johnson. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify to the members on behalf of the members of the Minnesota Home Care Association. My name is Neil Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Home Care Association, and with me is Barb Brandt, our government relations director. I'm here to ask that you do not freeze the proposed 2% COLA increase intended for home and community-based services providers on July 1, 2008. The Minnesota Home Care Association represents a wide variety of home care providers in the state of Minnesota. By far the largest group of organizations within the MHCA provider community is Medicare-certified home care agencies. These agencies provide both skilled and long-term care to individuals and families in their communities. These agencies are in many ways the backbone of service provision in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota law requires that a home care agency be Medicare-certified to provide home care to clients whose services are reimbursed through medical assistance. Besides providing home care services directly to the elderly and disabled, these agencies also provide services under the Elderly Waiver Program, Alternative Care Program, and other waivers. There are some exceptions to this rule, however. These options are more commonly seen in the metropolitan areas. They include personal care attendant services or PCA services, consumer-directed care, and customized living. PCA and consumer-directed services are provided in the community. Customized services are provided only in housing with services establishment or assisted living. These options pay for long-term care in the community, but when the client receiving this level of care needs skilled services, a Medicare-certified agency is needed to step in and to provide that level of higher level of service. It is important to remember that these alternative services only offer home health aid or personal care services. They are not able to provide skilled care that includes nursing and therapy services in the home. For Minnesota to remain a state that offers cost-effective and quality services, Medicare-certified agencies must remain a vibrant part of both the health care and long-term care systems. However, the number of these agencies has been on a slow but steady decline since 2001. At that time, there were 250 Medicare-certified agencies around the state. A study done by the Minnesota Department of Health on access to senior health services in Minnesota at that time found that throughout the state of Minnesota, there were at least two or more Medicare-certified agencies available to provide services in the home. It was determined at that time that individuals living anywhere in Minnesota had access to and choice of agencies to provide home care services. Today, however, there are only 210 Medicare-certified agencies in the state. This is 40 less agencies in a little more than 6 years. It's a 17% reduction, and this number continues to fall. Over 55% of the Minnesota counties now have only one or no Medicare-certified agency located within their borders. Based on the previous assumption that two or more agencies are needed to provide options for care, we now have an access issue in Minnesota. Our provider organizations tell us that this is happening because reimbursement for services has changed dramatically and the cost of care has escalated just as dramatically. When Minnesota first started to provide home care services, and I don't need to give you a history lesson, but I will, home care services reimbursed through medical assistance in 1985, payment was based on a cost reimbursement methodology that was tied to Medicare rates. However, since 1985, MA rates for home care services have either been frozen or reduced 12 times. If this freeze continues again in 2008, it'll be the 13th time in 22 years. During that time, rates have gone up 32.5%. However, during that same interval, the cost of living has increased by 94.25%, or three times the amount of rate increases. According to Medicare home care cost report data for Minnesota, It shows that MA rates for home care services cover, on average, less than 48% of the cost of care. At one time, Medicare-certified agencies were able to cost-shift some of their expenses to Medicare because that payment system remained cost-reimbursed until about 1996. However, that is no longer possible, since either state or federal programs have been the main sources for payment over these services in home care. Many home care agencies have gone out of business. And if you followed some of the federal budget issues, they're talking about freezes and cuts as well for home and community-based services. Today, although there are an increased demand for services, the cost for providing services are rapidly escalating, making it hard to provide these services. Agencies have seen dramatic increases in mileage costs due to increased gas prices. There are increased costs to attract and retain competent, high-quality employees due to a nursing shortage and also competition from other better-paying job opportunities. This has created staff turnover issues. Lastly, there are increased demands for technology, electronic billing, telehome care, electronic health records. To deal with these demands, the agencies that remain open report that they are reducing their service areas so their staff are not driving longer distances anymore. Many are also no longer providing waivered services as a way to limit the percentage of services they offer that are reduced at the lower MA levels. Both of these actions further reduce access to certain levels of care, even though Medicare-certified agency remains present in the community. Agencies also report having to reduce the benefits they offer their employees. This has reduced access to health insurance for employees and their families. Wage increases have had to remain lower than the increase in the cost of living. This has resulted in staff turnover, which provides great challenges to providing continuing continuity of care. Medicare-certified agencies are hard to replace. Few new agencies are coming on the scene. I did check with the health department before I came here today, and they report that there are about six Medicare-certified agencies in the hopper right now that they're setting up initial interviews for. And because of the high cost of startup and long waits for initial certification process to be completed, I talked to some of our consultants, and they estimate anywhere conservatively it takes about $150,000 to $200,000 to start a Medicare-certified agency right now. They're required to have 3 months of operating capital, to serve 10 skilled clients, and to have a $50,000 surety bond. So it's definitely a costly proposition to get into. And also performers are not able to demonstrate a return on investment, so outside investors are not interested. The Minnesota Home Care Association asked that on the short term that the legislature maintain the 2% increase in rates for home and community-based services in 2008. In the long term, however, we ask that you pass rebasing legislation that identifies a better payment methodology for home and community-based services so that Minnesotans have continuing access to essential services in their homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Dick Derricks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Dick Derricks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Minnesota Dental Association strongly objects to the use of the Health Care Access Fund to balance the state's general fund budget, including the use of the Health Care Access Fund to pick up health care costs that are the obligation of the general fund, as proposed in the governor's budget. These dollars have always been intended to be used for Minnesota care services and related health care programs. When patients and the health care and the health care providers are taxed for the general obligations of the state, such patients are unfairly taxed and burdened, and the original promise of the program is broken. Such inappropriate use of the Health Care Access Fund is especially of concern because there is a higher and better use for these funds. Dental access has been a major topic of concern for this year's legislature, and it's been an ongoing concern for the dental community. And as we all know, the state's public programs are substantially underfund the cost of dental care provided to Minnesota care and medical assistance patients. With leadership from the Senate, the Health Care Access Fund has been used in a significant way to close the underfunding gap in dentistry through the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. Health Care Access Fund dollars are critically needed for the expansion of the Critical Access Dental Provider Program and for other programs that can help to pay for the oral health care services that so many people in the state need through the state's public health care programs. On the business side, dentists are often unable to pass the cost of the tax onto the third-party payer as originally intended in the legislation. And there are significant incentives in the system that discourage the tax from being itemized on claim forms. And as a result, dentists are particularly concerned when the tax is not used for its intended health care purposes and instead used to balance the state's budget. And so in conclusion, it's the Minnesota Dental Association believes that it's important to keep health care access fund dollars working for their intended purposes, including access to oral health care for the underserved. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I guess not. Thank you again for your testimony. That completes our agenda for today, members. I thank you very much for your attendance.